This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we remember drummer Elvin Jones, who died Tuesday at the age of 76, following a long period of failing health. Jones was one of the greatest and most original drummers in the history of jazz. His most influential work was with John Coltrane from 1960 to 66. Jazz critic Francis Davis wrote this about Elvin Jones for The Village Voice. It was the complexity of his own subdivisions, the artful suggestion of triple meter over a basic four, that kept you riveted after the shock wore off. He was the drummer most crucial to the evolution of jazz in the period following bop, and you feel sorry for the generations who will know him only from his recordings, denied the thrill of watching him in action. After leaving the John Coltrane Quartet, Jones led a number of small groups known as the Elvin Jones Jazz Machine. His career lasted over 50 years. Terry Gross spoke with Elvin Jones in 1998, shortly after his 70th birthday. Before speaking about his work as a drummer, they talked about his childhood and his family. Jones was born into what would become one of the most celebrated families in jazz. His older brother Hank Jones is a distinguished pianist. His brother Thad, who died in 1986, was a cornetist, arranger, and bandleader. Elvin's first recording as a leader, made in 1961, featured both of them.
I've wanted to play since I was 2 years old. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted to play drums. I've never really wanted to play another instrument. You know, we had a piano, and Hank had an older sister who played piano as well. She was a classical pianist. And Hank, you know, all the rest of it, we all, my other brothers and sisters, all everybody took piano lessons and they could do something, at least play the scales.
How did you know that it was drums for you?
Because I saw them. I used to see the circuses and Ringling Brothers. We lived in a place in Pontiac, Michigan, where right in front of our house was a huge, great open field, I guess about, you know, maybe 1,000 acres or so. And it was just where all the circuses used to come and it passed right by our house to you know, with all the elephants and, you know, zebras and horses and all of that, camels and all these things. I used to see them when I was a little boy. And I'd see the, they would always have a circus parade, basically. And I just got fascinated with the drums, with the percussion. I'd watch the drummers, you know. They'd be dressed up in these fancy, beautiful uniforms. I thought similar to, I guess, to the uniforms I used to wear when I started playing in a high school band. But I guess that started me off. So I was just enraptured with that, and I always, and I would follow that band for a mile or so, and just to walk next to the drummers.
You were in the marching band in school, weren't you?
Oh, yes.
Do you think that the kind of parade drumming and marching band drumming that you were so fond of as a child affected your drumming later in life?
Well, certainly I developed a good sense of time because one had to march. And for the standard tempo was 120 beats per minute. And, of course, that it does something to you if you march for 2 or 3 miles and go out to play a football game and go through the formations, making letters and whatever. And I think it certainly gives you another sense of what percussion really is all about, and what and how it relates and how it blends with everything else. That's it's just as much a part of music as any other instrument in a band.
When you started to play the drums, what did you do to strengthen your hands and to learn how to coordinate your hands and your feet?
Oh, God. Well, I didn't start using my hands and my feet that much. I started simply with a pair of drumsticks, a textbook, and a drum pad. And altogether, the old thing cost about less than $3. And it was not so easy to get $3 in those days. But I was just trying to learn the basics. I tried to learn the rudiments. I did what the assignments given to me by my teacher.
How old were you before you had an actual set of drums in your house instead of just a drum pad?
Oh, I think I was 21 years old. I had been in the Army, to the Army Air Corps, rather, and did my service. And when I got discharged, with the mustering out pay that I had, I borrowed another $35 from my oldest sister. And I bought a set of drums. That's the first set of drums I ever had. I was over almost 22 years old.
When you got out of the military, I think for a while you played in a house band in Detroit at a club where a lot of well-known musicians came, and you accompanied them. So that must have been a great way to get exposed to playing with a lot of people.
Yes, it was. It certainly improved my education a great deal. Because my main purpose was try to learn as much as I could about what the music that had fascinated me so much. Because I was in the Army, I was in the Air Corps when I first heard organized big time, what I thought was some of the greatest music I'd ever heard in my life, on a recording. I heard Dizzy Gillespie and Big Sid Catlett was the drummer, who he's just amazing, this guy. They played Dizzy's composition of Salt Peanuts, and Sid Catlett played an eight-bar introduction, and with brushes, and I never heard anything so beautiful, so precise, so musical that I was completely enraptured by that. And so from that point on, I've listened to every record that I could possibly get. You know, there weren't many records floating around in the barracks in those days, and they're all. And even if they were, it was not so easy to find a record player to play them on. We had one, and the needles were all dull, but we managed to listen to it anyway. But I thought that was just fascinating. I was just fascinated. I've been fascinated from that point on. I've never lost that enthusiasm. I think it's just the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard in my life.
How did you end up playing with John Coltrane in the early 60s? When you first started playing with him in the early 60s?
Well, before that, when I lived on East 6th Street, right off 2nd Avenue, and on 4th Street and the Bowery, It was this club, the Five Spot, one of the first Five Spot. And there I met Thelonious Monk, who was playing there every night with John Coltrane and with Shadow Wilson and Wilbur Ware, who was the bass player. And I used to sit there every night with a, you know, hold a glass of beer for 3 or 4 hours and listen to that music. And anyway, that's how I first I met John Coltrane there. And then later he started to play with Miles Davis Band, and then I had occasion to substitute for Philly Joe Jones once or twice. And during this time, John asked, was thinking about forming his own group, and he asked me if and when this happened, would I consent to play with him? And I told him I certainly would, and he only had to, when the time came, all he had to do was ask me.
Jazz drummer Elvin Jones speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Jones died Tuesday at the age of 76. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we return to Terry's conversation with jazz drummer Elvin Jones, let's listen to something recorded live at the Village Vanguard in 1961 with John Coltrane and Elvin Jones on drums. This is Coltrane's composition called Spiritual.
If your drumming in the opening of Spiritual, as recorded at the Vanguard, was composed before, you know, was thought out beforehand, or if this is improvised?
It was all improvised. We never had a rehearsal in the whole time that we were together. Not one time. Everything was improvised. As a matter of fact, I never really knew until I heard a downbeat exactly what it was we were going to play. It was sort of like that. You know, once you started to play it, and we just sort of fell, sort of rallied around the flag. And it came off like that. I don't know, it's very unique. I've never had that kind of experience ever before or since.
Did you ever say to him, I want to know more before we start?
No, I didn't have that much. I couldn't. He was a band leader. I thought he could play anything he wanted, and I knew he was capable of playing anything. You know, he could play the New York Philharmonic if he wanted to. You know, he had that kind of discipline. You know, he was disciplined as well as any other musician I've ever seen. You know, in any kind of orchestra or whatever. And so he knew exactly. John always knew what he was doing, and he had confidence enough in the rest of us that we would be able to complement and enhance and make it into something that was tangible.
Now, you've said that the band would never rehearse. I imagine you didn't see any charts or sheet music before playing. Is that right?
No.
No?
It was all in our head, all in our minds.
When John Coltrane's solos got longer, and then your solos got longer too. I wonder what it was like to accompany him in like what 40-minute solos. I mean, that's about the length of a whole set.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, there was one occasion in Philadelphia where you are now. you remember the Showboat Lounge?
Yeah, that was a jazz club before I moved here. Yeah.
Anyway, we used to play there quite often, and Pep's Bar and all, and the Blue Note up in North Philly. At we used to play. You know, the routine was on Saturday or Sunday afternoon. It would be a matinee, and we played a matinee this particular matinee. John was playing a very fast tempo piece, and something happened to his horn. I guess pad fell out or whatever, you know, and it was just all he could barely get a tone out of. It was just squeaks and squawks. So, and he wouldn't stop. And so he played until he finally started making scales out of all of these sounds that were coming out of his horn. And he played this piece for 3 hours. But the thing about it is, when we finished, I was ready to play the next piece. I said, okay, what are we going to play next? And the matinee was over, you know. So you're talking about 40 minutes was not. I thought the way that group was, I think it was the time didn't really have any significance. You know, I didn't get tired. Nobody got tired. It was just to pursue an idea or a mode to its natural conclusion. And if it took an hour or 40 minutes or 2 hours or whatever, then that so be it.
What about when the music of the group started moving away from time signatures and getting freer? As the drummer, how did you feel about that?
Oh, just like anything else, I don't think any. It didn't. It really didn't matter. Because that's what you refer to as an abstract, and so it was nothing strange about being about abstracts. Because I used to like to watch. Go to a museum in Detroit. You got a lot of Jackson Pollock's paintings, you know, and Matisse and Picasso and all these guys. That's all abstract, you know. I didn't think it was any different than anything else. It's just a musical abstract, but the portrait is there, nevertheless.
What were your brothers, Hank Jones and Thad Jones, reactions to your work with Coltrane? Did they think it was getting too far out? Did they like it?
I guess so. I don't know. Yeah, I know that they liked me, you know, and that's the main thing. They didn't care what I played. I'm the baby boy.
So did you not even know what they thought of the music?
No, I never. They always knew I could play very well, and I knew I was a good drummer, and they told me that many times.
Jazz drummer Elvin Jones speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Jones died Tuesday at the age of 76. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The mischievous fairy tale Shrek began as a 1990 book by the late William Steig about a warty ogre and an even wartier princess. Transformed into a smash animated feature in 2001, it's now spawned a sequel, Shrek 2. David Edelstein has this review.
It was weird to be maybe the only person on the planet indifferent to the original Shrek, with its eyesore colors and smirky in-jokes and fast-talking black guy sidekick disguised as a donkey. I felt like, well, an ogre in a sea of happy pixies. I admit that was a sourpuss reaction, because Shrek did have great stuff. The first scene, for instance, in which the uncouth bug-eating monster hero uses a prudish old fairy tale as toilet paper, or the evil Lord Farquaad's exhortation to his troops, which looks more prophetic every day. Some of you may die, but it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make. I wasn't prepared, though, for the blast of happiness that is Shrek 2. It's a leap forward on every level, beginning with the plot, which isn't another cookie-cutter odyssey. The movie opens with the ogre Shrek, voiced by Mike Myers, and his princess bride, Fiona, voiced by Cameron Diaz, on their honeymoon. In the last film, a father ashamed of the curse that made her a part-time ogre had locked the fair Fiona in a tower. But in the climax, she learned that it was the conventionally willowy blonde who wasn't her real self. Now, the lovebirds revel in their shared ogreishness. They're even unfazed by the pitchfork-wielding mob that tends to come out when flatulent green giants have noisy, albeit PG-rated sex in the middle of their fields. The problem is that no one will let them live happily ever after as ogres. The couple knows they're in trouble when an invitation comes from Fiona's mom and dad, the king and queen, voiced by John Cleese and Julie Andrews, who don't realize that their beauteous daughter has not only married a mammoth, trumpet-eared slab of green beef, but joyously become one herself. Dinner at the castle with the in-laws is no picnic.
Bon appétit!
Oh, Mexican food! My favorite!
Well, let's not just sit here with our tummies rumbling. Everybody dig in.
Don't mind if I do, Lillian.
So, I suppose any grandchildren I could expect from you would be...
ogres. Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Right, Harold?
Oh, no! No, of course not. That is assuming you don't eat your own young...
Dad!
Oh, no, we usually prefer the ones who've been locked away in a tower.
Shrek, please.
I only did that because I love her.
Oh, hi. Daycare or Dragon Guarded Castle?
You wouldn't understand. You're not her father.
It's so nice to have the family together for dinner.
It's a shock when the king hires an assassin to bump off his new son-in-law, but a happy one when it turns out to be Puss in Boots, voiced by Antonio Banderas. The former Zorro stops the show by recasting the Mexican Avenger as an impudent feline with a weapon more disarming than a foil, a pair of schlock kitty painting saucer eyes that are impossibly adorable. Although Eddie Murphy's donkey warns him the position of annoying talking animal has already been taken, sharing that function is the best thing that could have happened to this braying ass. The issue in Shrek 2 is not how one rescues a princess, but how one makes the marriage work within a family and a society that has problems with what you might call the alien other. Even Fiona's sugary fairy godmother, voiced by absolutely fabulous's brilliant Jennifer Saunders, can't handle it. Behind that twinkly facade, she turns out to be a steely corporate creature and the mother of Prince Charming, who feels entitled to the princess. She hatches a plan to turn the young woman back into a willowy blonde. She's the true target of Shrek 2. She's like a Disney executive with firm and acquisitive ideas about what constitutes happily ever afterdom. You could say the film boils down to a progressive plea on behalf of so-called misfits to let them stay true to their essential misfit selves, a lesson in how to keep your head when those around you are surgically altering theirs. Fortunately, there's no need to boil it down. Just a frolic in the wave upon wave of parodies, songs, and stupendous visual and vocal turns. I still don't love the 3D virtual reality look. My taste runs to cartoons that are cartoon-like, that tickle your synapses by madly altering the laws of time and space in the manner of last year's Triplets of Belleville. And my ideal animated film would have fewer fast food tie-ins and more original songs. But that final rush of demented fairy tale revisionism, the Godzilla gingerbread man, Pinocchio reenacting Mission Impossible in ladies' underwear, the king who looks better as a frog, to resist it all, you'd have to be an ogre. I take that back. Ogres are a gas.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate.